You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Big Square in our comic strip. Green Beret, Green Beret, this is your friendly fact. Let me take some photographs in case you don't get back. Turn this way a little. Hold it, that's the style. You're on candid camera, so let me see you smile. Green Beret, Green Beret, they're shooting at this fact. I hear the bullets whistling by, I hear the rifles crack. I'm missing my siesta, I need a taste of rum. If you no longer need me, I guess I'll head for home. Oh, thank God our fighters now circling overhead. Charlie's gonna wish that he had stayed home in bed. He's gonna meet his maker in the land that is to be. We're gonna blow his body up and set his spirit free. Friendly fac and fighters, I hope you see our smoke. That first strike came too close to us, it really was no joke. Green Beret, we're holding high, the fac, he got it wrong. Thought that you were marking the position of a calm. Fighters, this is friendly fact. Please hold it high and dry. We can get this straightened out if we all really try. Doesn't really matter if I marked a friend or foe, 'cause you can't hit a cow's rear end no matter where you go. Fighters, you're cleared in again. Please do the best you can. Situations all fouled up beyond the help of man. Just bomb the general area when the smoke clears out. We'll just count the bodies and let God sort them out. Now most of us are safe at home. We beat the dreaded calm. We simply let it hang all out to help the war along. A friendly fac and fighters will always save the day. Killing off the Charlie to the last damn Green Beret.
Okay, that's the song of the Green Berets, and now I have the real privilege of introducing two veterans, and we're going to talk and stop the CD. And, of course, my first guest is my friend, Joe Eggert.
Hello.
Who not only is a veteran, but he's now a realtor with Weikert.
Yep.
And for those of you who know his daughter, who worked here and was wonderful, we just loved her. And, of course, as a result, we tolerated Joe. And, of course, Adrian now is home with the Joe's wonderful little grandson, and so we welcome you. And my second guest today is Adam Macow. And Adam, I know you've been on before. I don't know much about you. I know you're retired. How can anybody retire, right, Joe? I mean, it seems to me that we all have to work until they carry us out in a box.
Well, that's me, but some people can. Adam's one, and I God bless him.
Well, fortunately, I worked for a company that has put me in a very good position to retire, but I am very busy in Holland Township Community Emergency Response Team. I am a volunteer hunter education instructor and active with the Military Order of Purple Heart, and somewhat with, since I transferred to the Milford VFW, I don't find a lot of spare time these days.
Well, that's what everyone who retires tells me. But I'd like to, just have the two of you talk, because I think that, unfortunately, so many of the young people today don't understand, and especially don't understand Vietnam. And, you know, if you talk to anyone who's 20 or a teenager, I mean, they're living in a very different country. I mean, we were not under attack then. You know, there was the draft. There's not the draft today. I think there's a whole different view of things. But I know personally, I think that the reason I like to talk to Vietnam veterans and have Vietnam veterans on, and I've been playing music from Vietnam, is we didn't appreciate the veterans when they came back. We didn't appreciate what they did. We didn't appreciate their struggles. And that wasn't true. I mean, Second World War, you know, we understood why we went to war during the Second World War, because we were under attack. But I'd like to have you try to, you know, let's us just have a conversation, or have you have a conversation, because I think it's important. And as you know, anyone who's interested can also download the program. So, Adam, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, how is it that you went into the service?
Well, I know in my high school yearbook it says Marine Corps under my picture. I'm not really sure if that was the urging of my buddy Billy, who kept wanting to join the Marine Corps on the buddy plan. And at that point, actually, I was doing an apprenticeship as a machinist and had a couple of years to finish, and this guy Billy kept urging me to join the Marine Corps. And I said, Bill, give me a couple of years to finish up and then we'll do it. Well, in the interim, Bill and his girlfriend wound up having a baby, and my deferment, my apprenticeship ran out. And also, I just remembered that there was a little occurrence happened in a bar in Staten Island when I was about 18, and I was talking with an older gentleman, and he said, what do you plan to do? Are you going to go into service? And I says, yeah, I'm joining the Marine Corps. And he says, don't bother. You'll never make it. I says, what? What is this guy talking about? Well, I did, and I enlisted. And at one point, I think everybody in boot camp asked themselves the question, what the hell am I doing here? The people I worked for said I could get a deferment. I could, because we did a lot of government work for the military. And I said, my father served in World War II. He was called back in for the Korean War. My mother's cousins were Marines in the Pacific during World War II. My uncle served with a fighter group in Burma. And then, of course, we heard JFK say, ask not what your country can do for you,
but what you can do for your country.
And, of course, I wanted to see what it was all about, so he and I went. So,
you know, you've put that, you know, and Joe and I were talking a little bit before. You're right, because most of us grew up as children with fathers who'd been in the Second World War. And I grew up in Wisconsin, but it was very honorable. In fact, out there, most people joined the Navy, I think, because they'd never seen a ship. So they just thought they'd, right. You know, yeah. They'd join the Navy. But so that you actually enlisted, and where did you serve? Where were you, and what kind of training did you get in the military?
Well, at that time when I went in, the infamous 1968 Tet Offensive occurred. It actually started, I think, the day I went into boot camp. And boot camp was actually shortened, I think, by 3 or 4 weeks. And it was like the express train to Vietnam. And I said to myself, well, hey, I just served an apprenticeship. I have papers. I'm a machinist. I'm a journeyman. They'll put me in an armory, or I'll be in a machine shop or something like that. But that was not the need. The need was for riflemen. So I was on the express train to Vietnam. We got to, after Paris Island, we had a bit of leave, which I went home and got married to my girlfriend. And we're still married to this day, still working. And then it was
maybe chaos. Because you're away for a whole year.
Well, isn't the earlier years the years of bliss?
Yeah, but see, you got to delay them.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. But then it was Camp Lejeune. You got your specialist training. And then it was jungle training in California. And our commanding officer said, this is not right that you guys should train and go right to Vietnam. We're going to train 7 days a week, and you're going to get 36 hours of liberty. My then wife flew out to California, and we spent 36 hours together. She sewed my new PFC stripes on my uniform. We went to dinner in a Polynesian restaurant that was, I guess, popular in vogue at the time. And while we sat there and we had our dinner and drinks, some gentleman off in the restaurant bought us our dinner.
Well, that was nice because those kinds of things weren't happening back then much.
Well, I think the waitress said he typically did this for young soldiers. And I don't know, maybe he had a son or something that was in the military, but a lot of times nowadays, if I see a young soldier in a restaurant or something like that, I tell the waitress, it's on me, you know?
Well, that, you know, that would be something all of us could do. And I think that the one thing I've seen in airports and in other places, you know, soldiers are, you know, people go up and welcome them. And, you know, it's so much different now than I know so many of you experienced back then. Joe, what was your situation? How is it that
mine was kind of different? I was at the time I was born and raised in Newark, New Jersey, and I went to school, graduated high school, and my mother asked me, "Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to go to college or not?" And I said, "Well, Mom, I like to hang out." So I was the typical guy, the greaser, hanging out on the corner doing doo-wop music and doing all that. I just said, "You know, I'm going to take time off." Well, Uncle Sam saw that, and I immediately got my draft notice. So I didn't enlist. I'll be very honest. I was drafted. At the time, they were back. This was 1965. They were drafting all of Newark, New Jersey. So we all went down to 1040 Broad Street, a ton of us. Went through the physical, got on the bus, went down to Fort Dix for one day. And then we all got on a bus and went up to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and formed a brand-new organization that was out of existence, we'll call it. They retired the colors and brought them back, called the 196th Light Infantry Brigade. And I was in Fort Devens, Massachusetts. So here I was in Fort Devens, Massachusetts, with a bunch of people I never knew or met. A lot of them were from Newark. And I did my basic training with the 2nd Battalion, 1st Infantry. You know, you do your basic training. Then they send you home, and then they said, okay, when you come back, you do advanced AIT, advanced infantry training, is generally what it's called. So I came back, and there was a big kiosk in the center of the fairgrounds, and I went up there, and you find your name, and you find out what unit you're going to and what's your MOS, which is your military job, military occupation. And I looked down, and I saw my name, and they said, go to medical school. And I'm like, I had no experience in medicine or nothing like the kind of like that. But they now pulled me out to be a medic. So I joined a medical unit in Fort Devens called the 8th Support Medical Support Battalion. And most medics, 99% of the medics in the Army, went to Fort Sam Houston, but not us. We trained right in Fort Devens and Boston Army Hospital. So I became a medic, as they say. And it was kind of like I kept saying to myself, I'm sure glad I never have to use this, because I didn't enjoy the sight of blood, to be honest with you, even though they use play blood and all this. And then we get orders that we packed the boats. We had two boats called the Apache and the Darby, and they were troop transports. We went down to Boston Harbor, and we filled them up because we were on orders, and they leaked it out that we were supposed to go to the Dominican Republic or Santo Domingo to replace the 82nd Airborne who was in garrison there. I go home, tell my mother, not to worry, Mom. I'm going to bring a guitar and sneakers. It's going to be great. And my last day at home, we saw on the news that the president of Santo Domingo said, I don't want no more U.S. troops here. I don't want them out. So we go back, and now we felt, uh-oh. The sword of Damocles is hanging over our head now. We knew it. Two ships, supposed to be combat-ready group, team of light infantry brigade. And sure enough, we got orders changed to Vietnam. So we went through the Panama Canal, up through, stopped at Long Beach, California for one night. And they had the nerve to let 4,000 men off at a Navy base, knowing they're going to Vietnam. It was like the movies. They were bringing them up the gangplank, dragging them up, dragging them up. They were just, it was a joke. So we went to and landed at Vong Tau, and then we set up a major base camp over there in Tain in Vietnam at the base of the mountain called Nuba Dinh, or Black River Mountain. And so I went there, and we set up a MASH hospital, and I was a hospital corpsman for 6 months, doing emergency room, flying dust off, doing that. And it was somewhat enjoyable. I mean, you felt like you were doing something.
Oh, you really were. I mean, yeah. I guess, you know, certainly I know that my brother, who was in and wouldn't take any schools, wouldn't agree to go to any schools, so he went to advanced infantry school. And I guess that's what a lot of the guys did when, you know, they didn't want to up for more time than they had to.
If you went to advanced infantry training, you know what you were doing. You were a rifleman. As they say, you were.
I don't think in many cases you got much of a choice.
You didn't have a choice. Yeah, they told you where you were going. Mm-hmm. I didn't say, well, geez, I'd like to be an electrician. They told you. And again, I don't know how.
Well, actually, for some reason, I think, and I may be wrong, I think they would have given him some schools, but he had to up for more time. And he said, no, you've got me for as long as you have me.
Yeah.
And that's it. So then he went to advanced infantry. And of course, you know, was a grunt over there.
Yeah.
So you were in the Army, you were in the Marines. How, you know, we always assume that the Marines are different than Army. Was that the case in Vietnam, or were you working pretty much the same?
I guess we did a lot of the same things, but we had a very miserly budget. Jokingly, we always said when the Army got tired of something, they either gave it to the Marine Corps or the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scouts got first choice at it. And a lot of our equipment was left over from World War II in Korea. Even a lot of the rations we were eating, eventually they stepped up into the 60s with the dates on the ration cartons, but... Yeah, a lot of the things were left over, and we didn't quite have the budget the Army did. But on one occasion, somebody said to us, well, do you guys know that there are 7 to 9 men working to support you in the field? I says, oh, aren't I lucky?
Yeah, that's what they are. It's very true, though. Yeah, but we never. The Army operated totally to me independently of the Marines. Marines were somewhere in Vietnam, and we were somewhere in Vietnam. But
we had on occasion helicopter support from the Army, and sometime artillery support, and on some occasions on some operations, the battleship New Jersey fired those 16-inch guns for us when we were around the Laotian border.
Oh, so that's in the area you were around Laos, or in Laos, probably.
Yes, we did go there, and that was hush-hush. And anybody who was a casualty was killed in action near Quang Tri province. They never said Laos. But, we worked along the Laotian border and along the DMZ.
Yeah, we were in Cambodia. And we weren't supposed
to be in this country.
We weren't supposed to be in Cambodia, but we were there. Nobody tell you differently. We went into Cambodia. Absolutely.
Well, my brother Mike served. In fact, he was with Mike Baldwin from Raritan Township when Mike was killed. And they were in Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, the 28th Infantry Regiment. And they were coming in from Cambodia. It was the North Vietnamese had apparently planned to try to circle Saigon in a Tet type offensive. And so they were obviously in and near Cambodia and probably in Cambodia. And Mike was a squad leader when he was killed. And, you know, he's probably, you know, the distance that we are, again, you know, 10, 20 feet away from my brother when he was killed.
Yeah, one individual, a former Holland Township police chief, was telling me that they carried AK-47s that was typically the North Vietnamese weapon of choice, because where they operated, that was their best resupply and ammunition, was to use the enemy weapons.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, Joe, you saw a little blood, not the fake stuff, when you were in Vietnam, because,
oh my God,
you know, the medical corpsman, I don't know, did you ever go out on the helicopters? Because
oh my God.
I know my brother said that.
I think I share, over Vietnam, you have most of the medics, there was a story of that you would try to rotate a medic 6 months in the field, 6 months in the hospital, which was, you know, the hospital, we'll call it, is the better deal, because you at least had a bunk to go to at night and you had some meals. In the bush was way different. In my case, I spent my first 6 months in the hospital doing an emergency room, and I really got to like working in the emergency room. It sounds stupid, but it really tested your ability. You really had to think so fast. Unlike the MASH hospital, we had one doctor for seven litters, roughly. So you had seven medics and one doctor. So the train, I call it, would come in, the litter bearers on a mass casualty, and come in and drop one in front of you. And then you were working on this patient, and the doctor would come out and reinforce what you were doing, kind of instruct you, then go to the next. So you didn't have a doctor one-on-one on everybody. And then that's when you started getting into triage, which is a whole different world. So that is what I did for 6 months. And then in January 67, the old man and what came up to me said, there's a helicopter out there, get on it, get your stuff. You're going down to the Mekong Delta because they need medics down in the 9th Infantry. We're losing so many medics. So I go, oh boy, this is it. So then I jumped on there and I joined the 9th Infantry Division as a platoon medic. The outfit I was on was the 5th Battalion, 60th Infantry Mechanized, meaning all of our vehicles were what they call armored personnel carriers. And so we'd go out to the jungle in armored personnel carriers, about 10 of us. And so I spent 6 months in the field in the Mekong Delta with them. So I did both. And in between, I did fly helicopters on dust-offs. So I kind of like did it all. And
Well, I've been in the Mekong Delta, and I can't imagine, you know, how the guys were fighting over there. I mean, it was just unbelievably hot, humid,
mosquitoes. The mosquitoes were the largest thing you've ever
seen. Snakes.
My God. And the Plain of Reeds, we were one of the first U.S. troops in this area called the Plain of Reeds, where we jumped out of the helicopter, and I think I landed up to my thighs in just crap water. And we had to go through all that and then finally find some dry land. And then what do is you get trench foot. All the guys were, you know, you get trench foot when you're in too much. You got to keep your feet dry. So, it's a terrible place. Now my wife, Adele, says, hey, you're having a tour. Again, you took it to the Mekong Delta in areas like Ben Phuc and Mai Tho. And I go, you're not asking me to go because I have no desire to go back.
Well, it was interesting. I was there in the late 90s, and I did not take the regular tour. Mm. I went with a couple of friends. And, in fact, I asked my brother before I went over. I said, do you have any feelings about me going over? Because, you know, I know that there are people who have gone back. But anyway, he didn't. And it was incredibly eye-opening. I mean, but anybody who's ever been there, you know, why they thought that this, you know, could be a successful, I mean, it was just an incredible place. I mean, that, our guys are, you know, if you're over 4'10", I don't know how you could live in most of those places. And, yeah. And you know, some of those little, you know, holes that they would crawl through it was a beautiful country, but it just, I don't know who planned the strategy, but, you're right. I mean, how do you jump out of a helicopter and how are you always wet? And my brother said the same thing, that the biggest problem that they had most of the time was keeping dry. Did you find that same thing where you were, Adam?
If you weren't dry from wet from the monsoon rains, you were totally drenched in sweat. And I think the only reason my feet survived through the monsoon season, and somehow I think it started raining in sometime in September and stopped in April. But every night I would take my socks off and tuck them inside my shirt to dry out. And somebody says, but what if we get attacked? I says, well, then I go fight in bare feet. But I'm going to try and get my feet dried out. And that's what I did. But, I mean, typically in the mountains, it was very rough country. And it got pretty muddy. But I can't imagine being in the swamps and in the misery of those
leeches. Oh, my God. They stayed a leech.
the human waste. Fertilized rice paddies that people had to hide and literally drink to keep out of the enemy fire. But I recently talked to a friend, and he said he was on a patrol, and he was down south, and he was the last guy in the squad on this patrol, and they were walking across this rice paddy dike. And he was carrying a shotgun. And he says, maybe 75, 100 yards out in the tree line, he sees an enemy soldier pop out carrying a rifle. And he says, I could never hit this guy with a shotgun, too far away. He says, so I looked at him, and I gave him the peace sign. He gave me the peace sign back, and disappeared back into the jungle. He says he would have easily killed me with a rifle. He says, but probably the rest of the squad would have cut him down. But I just think that's
good story. That's a good. I mean, not a story, but I mean that's a good tale.
Well, Joe, you're right about the cities, and from what I understand, you know, cities like Newark and other places, and because they needed so many people. I'm not saying this about you, but they really were drafting people who did not belong in the service. I mean, they couldn't have passed any possible test to get in, but they were just taking everybody.
They were just going there. They hit Newark, where I was, you know, raised.
If you were warm and had a pulse, I think in
they were
cases,
just
they
wiping out the cities and then my whole outfit. My outfit was a fair amount of integrated. We had a large amount because they went through Newark, to be very honest. And we have had a large black population. And so in the outfits I was in, it was represented very much with African-Americans and all. We all got along. There was no animosity. You know, you do what you do. You have to survive. So I mean,
you know, the interesting thing, you know, I came... My brother came out of a small town in Wisconsin, and, you know, for whatever reason we know now, of course, there were no blacks in our town. And a lot of these kids came off the farms in Wisconsin, and, you know, they had never met anyone. You know, you were either Catholic or Lutheran or maybe Methodist, and that was the biggest difference. You know, everybody was Anglo. So that was another thing that
Now you got to remember, we were pretty young. We were all in our late teens, and we were all city guys, and now we're plucked to go in the army, and then you find yourself in the Mekong Delta. You're like, what the hell is going on here? You know, and it was an interesting year, I'll tell you that.
Well, you mentioned, I think a lot of the racial problems happened with people who were in rear areas that had a lot of time on their hands when they were off duty to get in trouble with drugs and booze and this racial business. Because out in the jungle, you know, whether you were white, black, yellow, tan, Hispanic, you were all brothers. And And I grew up in Rahway, and I grew up in a mixed neighborhood. And, you know, I had black friends, and we were at each other's houses. I went to Vietnam, and my first squad leader was a black guy, George from East Orange. My fire team leader was a black guy, Carl from Newark. And the other two guys in the fire team, they were black also. The hurdle with black-white animosity there was this one fella from New York City. He was a little unfriendly at first, but eventually, after living in the jungle as closely as we had to and depending upon one another, he said to me, you know, I think we're going to have to call you the white sheep of the fire team. And I lived with those guys as close as anybody could sure. for 4 months out in the jungle, and we had to survive.
Your life depends on it. Your life depends on that camaraderie. You know, everybody's got
well,
each other.
What happens,
back.
Though, when you came back and, you know, at least today when the men and women are coming back, although we have a terrible homeless problem, a terrible problem with employment, but at least they're being embraced by everyone. And I think that is so different from your experience. It had to be a real shock to come back and see what was happening in this country.
One of the big things that really annoyed us when we were in the jungle in, I guess it was 1969, we're sitting there on a hillside, and they're talking about the Paris peace talks. And as these SOBs are arguing over the shape of a table, well, we're in the jungle getting shot at. But coming home, I got kind of snubbed on a couple of job interviews when I said the last couple of years I'd been a Marine rifleman. And my father said, don't expect anything special just because you're a veteran. But I wish he could see what's going on now. But a little bit, I wonder if some of this is a little bit of guilt.
Oh, I'm sure.
From the way we were treated when we came home.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about those of us. And, you know, I'm not going to say I was pro-war. I wasn't. I was young at the time. But I didn't ever understand, could not understand, what business we had in Southeast Asia. I mean, it's not like Second World War when Japan attacked us. And, you know, it was just, for those of us who were young, many of us just could not understand why we were stepping in and basically taking over a stupid war that the French had been involved in for so many years and had never been able to.
We were there with the French, too. Back into the late 40s and early 50s, we supported them with aircraft and mechanics and things like that.
Right.
But then after a while, the French just gave up. They begged it and left. They had enough of it. They felt that they couldn't, you know. They were trying to protect their economic, the rubber plantations over there was a big source of economics for the French and tapiocas and all, but mostly the rubber plantations was the big money.
Michelin.
Well, and I guess also, you know, and I was very young, we all were, but I do remember in grammar school that we still felt that the communists were going to take over. And I think that's what they played on. I mean, I remember being told that we had to sit under our desks because we had to practice in
duck
case there was
cover.
A
duck
and cover.
In case there
get
was
under
a,
in case the big bomb was
the
dropped.
The big
yeah.
bomb. So I, you know, I think that was part of that mentality that somehow that if Vietnam fell to the communists, that
it's just,
you know,
the beginning of the domino
it'll
theory.
It'll be the next thing here.
Then the thing that really gets you mad, even now today, is when I see Robert McNamara got on TV. Who was the Secretary of Defense back in Vietnam. He says, you know, I knew we couldn't win that war. I knew it. And I'm like, you knew this.
Then why?
Why were you just throwing more men and bodies right. into there? And you just, just amazing to hear these people now in hindsight telling the true story about it.
Well, and you're right, because it was like,
More, you know, and Westmoreland kept going to the president. I need more men. Give me more men. When I went over in 66, we brought the troop strength up to 300,000. I remembered our brigade. And his answer was, I need more men, more men. So he kept building his troop strength up. Give me more. So they kept moving divisions in there and all. But it was a different war. It was, they were, it's a guerrilla warfare. And they were, fought it very well. They did things that we would never expected. And with guerrilla warfare is way different than any other kind of war we fought.
But that's the point. How is it that the powers to be didn't realize that, and that was even my impression when I went there in the Mekong Delta and other places. How in the world could our, you know, 5'8", 6-foot guys who were used to being fed well, how could they possibly, you know, it was hard. I could see that it would be hard to survive there, much less fight there. I mean, it was just, it seemed to me that they, you know, they just, the traditional powers to be, you know, never thought about a jungle warfare. I mean, I lived in Guatemala, and I know how difficult it would have been if we'd had troops fighting there because of the, you know, the jungle lowlands and the mountainous highlands. And I don't know, they just didn't seem to, you know, take that into account. And you certainly wouldn't have been able to follow anybody in those little rat holes that they, you know, those, the, what did they call them?
Tunnels.
The tunnels.
Oh, my God. When they would, they had tunnel rats. And, oh, my God, you want to talk about a job. They send a guy down, usually the smallest guy in the outfit, armed with a 45 and a flashlight. And he would go down the tunnel, knowing that next first bend around the tunnel could be somebody waiting for you. Oh, my God.
An explosive could be snakes.
Yeah, they could throw a grenade.
Snakes, deadly snakes hanging from the
ceiling. Oh, my God.
Well, and not
I didn't
to know.
Do that. Thank God.
And I know the one thing my brother said was not to know if kids were going to be friendly or they were going to be fighting you.
Well, it's almost like that is reminiscent. One more. That's kind of reminiscent of the pictures I see today overseas in, you know, over Iraq and Iran, Afghanistan with the young kids coming into suicide bombers and all, you know, they did that in Vietnam. So you when you saw a small kid coming up, you just couldn't come up and embrace him because you didn't know.
In my case, I was in what they call the free fire zone. Any friendlies were evacuated. If you saw someone, he was the enemy. And our enemy generally wore a pith helmet and a green uniform and carried an AK-47. He was a North Vietnamese soldier. Typically, we weren't harassed with the booby traps that the guerrilla warfare was, you know, it was a faceless enemy. I mean, you just walked along a trail and you were blown up. And there was nobody there you could fight. It was very frustrating. But in my case, it was more of a conventional warfare. But the jungle, everything out there had thorns. The elephant grass was like razors and anything that was there.
How about fire ants? You get any fire ants?
No, but we had some mighty big ants.
Fire ants would come down from the trees and get on you.
Scorpions.
Burn. Oh, my God. I've seen guys run down, take their clothes off, and find the nearest body of water, jump in.
Yeah, my buddy was just telling me a situation, a friend of mine that we were in the same squad in Vietnam. I see him several times a year, and he told me about the ants crawling down his back and peeling all his clothes off. And
yeah, they burn these, the red ants. They call them fire ants. Oh,
one of the big problems was jungle rot.
Anytime
you got a little cut or a nick, I got scars all over my arms and my legs, you get infected because there was no place to, no clean clothes. We were in the jungle for at least a month on most occasions. And there was no place to shower, no place to change clothes. And any sore you had got infected pretty severely. And
then the leeches. Oh, my God, to this day, leeches make me sick. Every time you cross a river, we would never cross the river with the boots blouse, which is tucked under, and you have to, because the water would fill them up and drag you down. So we would unblouse our pants, cross a river, get on the other side and pull up our pants leg, and there would be two or three leeches in there, and I had to go around, take them out, take the leeches out, and then give them some sort of liquid to keep it from getting infected. But, when the leech falls out of your body, the blood comes with it. So you got blood running all over your leg. But they're about the size of a man's thumb. They were disgusting.
Oh, they were little tiny things.
No,
like a matchstick.
No, mine were about
like a matchstick. Yeah, once they blew up.
They blow up. They're like the size of your thumb.
They're big as your thumb.
They're big as your thumb. And you just hang in your leg.
But the thing that I go back to is centipedes. I absolutely hate centipedes. I had one that crawled on me and bit me on the back of my neck. And I swiped him off, and he must have been about 6 inches long because he wrapped around my hand when I brushed him off, and the pain was severe. I went to the corpsman, and he gave me some of these and some of those pills. Take one of these, take one of them every 4 hours. Well, I just popped as many pills as it took to pass out, and for 2 days later, when the water dripped off my helmet onto my neck, it almost felt like I was getting like a little electric shock from that centipede. And man, I hate those.
Well, Joe, one of the things that we did here is that you were all able to save so many of the guys, even though they were pretty seriously wounded over there. And that was the first time, despite all of the...
Well, the
men who died, I mean, you saved so many of them.
Well, you could thank one, the helicopter. The helicopter was the first time a helicopter was used as a major ambulance. In that kind of environment, the Huey was godsend. When I flew dust off, you had seconds to land and get the guy on the chopper and get out because they're trying to shoot you down. And I always tell everybody it's probably the most exciting, invigorating 10 seconds of your life. After a while, you get out of it and you land. You go, you stupid. Because they call for a dust-off. The medic's in the field, and one of his guys got hit pretty bad. So the job of the medic in the field is to stabilize him. That's all he does. He stabilizes him, bundles him up to get him out. So he's doing the four basics that he does. He keeps him alive. That's his job. Stop the bleeding, prevent shock, and all of that. And that's all he's supposed to do. He's not there to administer more than that. Gives him morphine if it's required. You can't give morphine for every type of injury, but you give him morphine, get him stabilized, and then get him out. So then they call for the dust-off. Dust-off immediately gets dispatched. I'm the medic on board. And we go out, and then as you're coming into the zone, it's hot. They're firing at each other. The ground troops secure a perimeter to make a safe LZ. Then you identify with smoke, so the Viet Cong tries to bring the chopper over to them. So we go down what color smoke, and we identify the right color smoke. Then we come down and land, get on the ground, and get out of there in seconds. Meanwhile, the troops are carrying, the medic is carrying the guy, throws him into the chopper, and we land. And we take off, And at any given time, you've ever flew in a Huey, the doors are never closed. You never close the door on a Huey. And so then I'm on the board, and then I'm doing what I can to keep him alive to the next level, which is the hospital. So we bring him into the hospital, and the medics at the hospital take him and then do what they have to do.
Let me see if I'll play a song, and you tell me, because I think this is the kind of thing that you were doing.
Fill your mugs and glasses, and I'll sing to you a song of a fact called Cobra 7 and his fight against the Kong. We flew 3-core together, we worked it night and day, from the dusty strip at Coogee to the main street of Song Bay. He
was flying late one evening round the mountaineer Tainin, when he heard the choppers mayday, we're hit and going in. At the base of Tainin Mountain, he saw the Huey fall, started for the crash site and made a mayday call. He heard the voice on guard then, a survivor on the ground. There's three of us alive here and bad guys all around. As he looked down at the clearing, saw VC all about. Help was on the way now, but time was running out. He armed his Willie Peter, he still had two full racks, hose two off at the VC and stopped them in their tracks. Then he saw the Kong regrouping and once more moving in, fired his last two rockets and turned them back again. A Huey out of Tainin then arrived upon the scene. To cover for the rescue, he grabbed his M16. He was firing out the window, flying low across the trees, with the bullets swarming round him like a hive of deadly bees. The friendlies watched in wonder at this pilot bold and brave, one man holding back 20 while the Huey made the save. As they climbed aboard the chopper, saw the VC find the range, and they cried for Cobra 7 as he went down in flames. In the dusty heat of Three Corps, when the Army's long day ends, they speak in silent voices of the fact who saved their friend. From Lykay up to Budap, from Coochie to Phuklung, they remember Cobra 7 and his fight against the Kong.
Sound familiar, Joe?
No, yeah. It was funny. He was talking about Tainin. That's where I had the hospital at, and the base of the mountain, which is called Nubadin. So, yeah, that's it. I would just say, if you talk to any Vietnam veteran who was out in the bush, the sound of a Huey still, you know, you still hear it. Every time you hear it.
Every time you hear a helicopter, it turns my head.
My wife looked at me. We both look up, and I go, oh, yeah, there it is. You hear that certain pop, 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 and that was the sound of, oh, boy, when you heard that, that was great. Either he was coming in, taking you out of the bush, or he was bringing you food. It was always a sign of, it was a good sign, except for if you were hurt. Yeah. But, yeah.
Now, were you, well, if you were hurt, it was a great sign. I mean, my brother used to talk about, you know, how, yeah. You know, without the helicopters, there would have been.
That's the reason why the casualty rate was so phenomenal as far as people saved. It was all because of the Huey. Absolutely.
Now, would you when you were out and as a medic, would you be going out with the Huey or would you
be on
the ground?
I was on the ground.
Oh, so that 6 months, you were actually a medic on the ground.
Yeah, I was an APC, Armored Personnel Carrier.
Now, when
Delta.
You were back at the hospital, did you ever go out on the Huey to pick up people?
Yeah, that's when I flew to dust, yeah.
So you didn't just work at the hospital. There were times
I worked at the hospital, and then when they needed help on the Huey, then I'd go out on the Huey. But, you know, it depends on the need. And sometimes the Huey would be sitting on the pad, and they didn't have the medic to go on board, and I'd run out there and go. I'd go, and he wanted a little excitement, a little stupidity of me. But so we used to fly them, you know. I wasn't 100% dust off. I was an emergency room medic for 6 months. But
so why is it when you came back, did you ever think of going into the medical field when you came back?
Well, they asked me, but I got to tell you, it sounds silly. I'm not a nurturing guy. So I enjoyed, if you can use this term politely, the emergency room. I mean, that to me was hands on, boom.
Right.
Part of my other responsibilities than any other medic was to do post-op, which is you go into the ward and you have to take care of the men, check on their temperature, pulse, respiration. I didn't like that. You know, I'm not that kind of nurturing guy. That makes, I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, but what makes sense.
So when I came home, you know, I would have had to be more of a nurturing nurse, we'll call it an LPN, and then move up the ranks. And I just said, no, I didn't want nothing to do with it. So
you know, what you seem to be saying is that, and a lot of us can relate to that, if we've lived overseas and done something, that back here we would be considered not qualified. But, you know, you would have been the perfect person to come back and work in an emergency room here and think about some of those hospitals in Newark, because a lot of people can't take that kind of stress.
Well, after you come home, you just want to kind of like erase these things from your mind.
Anyway. That's true.
So I said, you know, that was it. Done.
We just went to a school,
Clinton Public?
Yeah, the grammar school.
Yeah.
And there was one young Marine there. He was actually an EMT and a firefighter, and he was going into nursing. I think he was going for a fairly high degree in nursing, and he had served in the Marines.
But you guys would never have thought of coming back and being a nurse, because back then only women were nurses.
That's right.
Well, I was going to come back and work in a machine shop, but that didn't work too well either.
Oh, so you didn't come back and work as a machinist.
Well, I tried, but then the company folded that I worked for. I went to a large instrument company in Newark, and for some reason there were two of us being interviewed in front of this executive, and he asked me what I had done, and I said the last couple of years I've been a Marine rifleman, I've been to Vietnam, and I've come home. And the other guy did all kinds of high-end progressive dye work, and the interviewer literally took his chair, turned away from me, and carried a conversation with this individual. And I said, well, I guess I don't have this one. And eventually I just started all over again and became an electrician, which I enjoyed a lot more, and because there was more freedom of movement, and you didn't stay in one place and stand statically behind the machine. It was, anyway.
And we met each other at Exxon.
Exxon.
We both worked together for, roughly 30 years.
Yeah.
30 years
and,
we were.
And I never knew he had been in the Army. I never knew that.
So when you came back, it sounds to me like it was more or less what happened after World War II. Everybody came back. They tried to get back into their lives the best they could. Forget about it.
Well, yeah, that's very true. I don't know about Adam or others, but I know I never, ever, and I use this all the time, ever said I was a Vietnam veteran. You just never did it. 9 out of 10 veterans never did. When we came back, it was you locked it in a box in your mind and left it there because you didn't talk like we're doing now. It was...
I can't say my experiences were exactly the same, because my father had been a commander in a DAV chapter when they had one in Rahway, and he was in a lot of VFW and American Legion. And literally these people came to my door and recruited me into these veteran organizations. But among veterans, there's a camaraderie that is, is very unique.
But then, you know what, you probably were lucky, because I know others that came back and tried to go into, some of the meetings, and these guys were all from World War II, and they just didn't feel like they had anything in common. So you were really lucky, apparently, that, they did bring you into the fold.
I joined the VFW when I came back. It was just like you said, all the World War II vets were there, and they were like, wow, and it looked kind of like, didn't say... You didn't feel welcome. Like, our war was so different than theirs, so I left the VFW. I said, I don't want this. And they talked about stupid stuff, so I left.
Well, I've heard Vietnam veterans say they got the comment, well, we won our war.
Yeah.
And I said, we didn't lose our war. Our country gave up there and pulled us out.
Well, I think the country never intended on winning that war, frankly. And I think they, you know.
But to give a plug, Adam and I belong to this group of renegades up in Glen Gardner. And
Ruth. Oh, no, I want you to, in fact, talk about that, because there may be some people out there that listen to the program or families that have listened to the program.
Greatest group of guys.
That don't know about this.
Every Tuesday morning, the official, unofficial meeting is, and there's not a meeting, it's a gathering. And you go up 31 in Glen Gardner going north, you'll go over on the right-hand side, you'll see 50 cars, 40 cars.
On this little side
On this little side road, and it's in front of a Mealy vacuum cleaner. And it started about 20 years ago, where a couple of vets went over there for coffee, and it just grew and grew to about how many?
Oh, well, actually, I don't know. There's must be about 50 guys all told. And we've lost a lot of World War II guys, but there's Korea. Vietnam is the big, big thing there now. But and John Chambari, the owner of Gem Vacuum, said it all started, he and a couple of vets would have coffee in the morning in some, I don't know, little cafe or something. And a lady asked them if they would please move on because they were a little too noisy. So John has been hosting this for
20 years.
20 years or
so. He's a great humanitarian, John. He's a wonderful man.
So tell people, what time does this start?
About on Tuesday? 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock starts, and then we have people come in, bring food. But the jokes, the fun, we have a big annual picnic.
And a lot of veteran information is there.
Yeah.
Well, that's important because...
There's some people there that are quite experts on VA benefits that will help you navigate the VA system. And there's a lot of information there. I mean, we could just say, hey, does anybody know this? And there's so much information there.
And that is really important. I keep going back to my brother, but my brother had to do me a favor and go down to the county clerk one day to get me my marriage license, of all things, back in Wisconsin. And he happened to stop in the veterans office, and he asked if what happened is they said, well, you know, you can't go to the VA. He said, well, all I'm trying to do is find out because I've had all this skin cancer. And, you know, I was out there and all that Agent Orange. Well, as soon as she heard that, she hooked him up immediately with the Madison, Wisconsin VA. And he said that they're absolutely the best. But he said he never connected all the cancer with,
that's one thing we do because we have quite a lot of guys there that know a lot. And we get a new veteran stops him because he heard about us. And one of the questions we ask, are you in the VA system? And he goes, no, I don't know. Why should I be? And we start not counseling him, but tell him that, you know, there's a lot of benefits to be known to go to the VA. There's some really good benefits there. And you deserve it. You earned it.
Absolutely.
So
well, you mentioned Agent Orange. There's a newsletter that comes out called the Agent Orange Review. And in that newsletter, they actually, there is a list of, ailments, whatever you want to call them, that are attributed to Agent Orange. And if you have these particular problems, you get compensation and help from the VA, and there's no disputing it. It's not the neuropathy due to diabetes. That is Agent Orange.
The VA has admitted, the Department of Veterans Affairs have admitted that if you were in boots on the ground in Vietnam, you were subjected to Agent Orange.
Well, and as I said, what my brother had very good health insurance, but he's found that because the VA has so much experience with this, that it's actually the doctors there are, you know, really up on all of it. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many times he's been back. The other thing, and I just wanted to share, and I hope you let everybody know, all of a sudden, probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, my brother got all these medals in the mail.
Yeah.
He had never had received his Purple Heart, and I'm not even sure what all the medals are, but, you know, he was wounded and all the rest of it. He got some Vietnam medal, and, you know, he would tell you, I don't know what they were. But it was all of a sudden, you know, like how many years later, 40 years later.
Well, there is an actually a government form. It's a 180 form, I believe, that you can send to the VA or to the